Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, after a long period of isolation, a more social summer is just around the corner, and that's especially exciting if you're looking to find a romantic partner. But wait, I'm not talking about humans and the ensuing hot vax summer with young adults being vaccinated. I'm talking about cicadas, specifically the Brood 10, a big group that will emerge en masse this spring in a matter of days in parts of the Northeast, we are told, as well as the Midwest and Southern U.S. They've been underground for a total of 17 years. Just imagine how much bread baking and Netflix they must have gone through. And here's what they sound like. The volume of these many, 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 many cicadas is one of the things that, depending on where you are in our area, you will be hearing soon, they say. With me now is one of the theys, Dr. Gene Kritzky, Dean of the School of Behavioral and Natural Sciences at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati, and author of many books on bugs, including Periodical Cicadas, The Brood 10 edition. Dr. Kritzky, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
First of all, am I saying the name of this insect correctly? It's cicada, not cicada?
You're correct. It is cicada.
What's a cicada?
Cicadas are insects that belong to the group that includes things like stink bugs and bed bugs and aphids, and they're more closely related to aphids than they are to bed bugs. They've got piercing, sucking mouth parts. There is a whole family of cicadas, about 3,000, but more than 3,000 species worldwide. And what we're talking about particularly are three species that occur once every 17 years that emerge together in year classes, which you call broods. And that's what's happening this year is the emergence of Brood 10.
What do they do for 17 years?
Well, it's not an exciting life. They've been underground, sucking on a tree root. And making tunnels and moving from part of the root to the next. They are xylem feeders. This is like people back to their biology courses, but that's the tissues that the vascular tissue that takes water and minerals from the soil up to the leaves. So they're feeding on that, and they're usually between for the first few years, but down between 6 to 12 inches below the surface, and then they go to between 8 and 4 inches for the middle years, and now they're probably within an inch of the surface net with a tunnel that goes down about 6 to 8 inches as well. And they've been quietly waiting for all the right conditions for them to come forward.
So how do they know to all come out at the same time?
Well, the trigger is temperature. Cicadas are really insects of climate. They when the soil temperature reaches 64 degrees Fahrenheit, that's the first inclination that something's going to happen for them. And then usually after a nice soaking rain, when those two conditions are met for a cicada year, that's when the emergence starts in earnest. Really good numbers happening.
But why 17 years? I mean, the conditions you just described happen every spring. Why isn't it 16 years or 18 years?
That's one of the discussions we've had for many, many years. And it turns out that 17 is a prime number, which is thought to be important. The thought is that being a prime number, there's no way that a predator or a parasite could evolve synchrony through intermediate stages. And
wow.
So that's protected them. Now,
prime number for the non-math nerds in the audience means it's not divisible by anything but itself and one?
And one. That is correct. And we have there's another group of periodical cicadas in the U.S. called 13-year cicadas, and that's also a prime number. And so, but we do know of two other kind of periodical cicadas. One has an 8-year cycle and one has a four-year cycle. So that prime number idea may not hold as much water as we once thought it did. We believe that the long life cycle in part is a response to their evolution during the ice ages and a way to cope with uncertain weather conditions. And this, and that they could have come out in 13 years, or if that wasn't suitable, they could come out in 17 years. And there may be just a single genetic switch that was involved with that.
Wow. So, listeners, we have time for a few questions. Everything you've always wanted to know about cicadas, but didn't have anyone over to dinner to ask, you can now ask Dr. Gene Kritzky at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Anyone listening seen or heard one yet this year? 646-435-7280. How long do they live? Are there any who would have been coming out in 2004, 17 years ago, and now again?
No, they actually we're looking at their kids. The adults and parents die shortly after the eggs are laid, and that they have a very short adult lifespan, just about 4 weeks, and it takes 2 weeks it takes 2 weeks for all of them to get out of the ground, and then the last ones out will live 4 weeks. So our experience with the adults lasts about 6 weeks. But you asked about where we're seeing them. I can tell you that Cicada Safari, the app that I developed for helping to map, the closest we've got, I've got reports of nymphs, not the adults yet, in Princeton and just north of West Windsor Township. We have some, I have a report from, a rather interesting report from, South Amboy is the closest to New York City that I've got.
That's close.
And we have historical records from New York. There may be some still on Long Island, but there are historical records that go back to 1919 and 1902 of them being in New York, and then one record from 1885 in Central Park. But nothing's been reported since, so they may no longer still be there. It's surprising to think of a periodical cicada as going extinct, but that happens. And, for example, Brood 11 was declared extinct in 1954. The last time we saw a Brood 11 cicadas was 1937, and that was up in the Boston area.
So what does brood 10 to refer to these cicadas mean? And where are broods 1 through 9?
Well, they're told that there's 15 broods in total, 3 13-year broods and 12 17-year broods. And brood 10 is a designation that was given to it in 1893. There was so much confusion about what different broods were. There was two brood systems for numbering cicadas and a third system that just used emergency year. And it was rather confusing. And so a man by the name of Charles Marlett said, okay, let's settle this. Every 17-year cicada that comes out in 1893, that's going to belong to Brood 1. Every 17-year cicada that comes out in 1894, that belongs to Brood 2, and numbers 1 through 17 were for 17-year cicadas. And then for 13-year cicadas, every 13-year cicada that came out in 1893, that was Brood 18, and numbers 18 through 30 were reserved for 13-year cicadas. So Brood 10 is the 10th in that numbering sequence, but it's of most significance because it emerges in a number of urban areas, and especially in the late 19th century, it was emerging in Philadelphia, Washington, Baltimore, and Cincinnati, and those were four of the largest cities west of New York in the U.S., and there were scientists there that watched these things and wrote stuff down. And so a lot of our fundamental information that we had early came from Brood 10 emergences, and usually major papers are published around Brood 10 because they occurred in such large areas, and and that's why this seems to be the biggest of the big. It is the biggest of the 17-year cicada broods, covering now 15 states in the District of Columbia. It's historically important as well as biologically important.
Let's take a phone call from Hugh. Are you in Sussex County or Suffolk County?
Sussex.
Just to be clear for our listeners, because I wasn't sure. Sussex is the westernmost county in New Jersey. Suffolk is the easternmost county in New York. So, Hugh, hi.
Hi. My question is, do cicadas cause leaf damage that will result in less than spectacular fall foliage year?
They can. The damage that's caused by the cicadas is when the female lays her eggs in the new growth of trees. And occasionally that process of laying her eggs, which she literally drills into the terminal branch of the of the tree and deposits her eggs. And that can sometimes tear up the vascular tissue, causing the leaves to turn brown. And sometimes that even, the tree will even break at that point. And it looks like it's been hit by a big hailstorm. It'll be ugly this year if it's heavy infestation. But back in 1869, there was an interesting paper published in the newspaper called American Entomologist that was titled, "Out of Evil Cometh Good." And it turned out orchardists in Illinois and Missouri, where Brood 10 had emerged the year before, were reporting a bumper crop the following year after a Brood 10 emerges. And so that damage, which you call that the cicadas call, which is called flagging, because it looks like the brown leaves are flags, actually leads to a greater flower set next year. So the trees may look ugly this year, but there's the potential of like a natural pruning. They can have a larger flower set next year. And so that's something that that we've been watching.
Randy in Pound Ridge, you're on WNYC. Hi, Randy.
Hi. So basically, we've had a bug at our house called a cicada killer for the past several years. They're very large, and they're very dangerous looking, and they're horrible. And and that was before this brood is going to be becoming a problem for us. I wonder if your guest can tell me anything about cicada killers and whether I'm going to see an influx of them as well.
Certainly, the cicada killer wasps do come out every year, and they're primarily adapted to feed on the annual cicadas, the ones that come, the cicadas that start coming out in early to mid-July and last through into the early fall. In most instances, the periodical cicadas will be dead and be carcasses at the base of trees before the cicada killer wasps come out. It's not to the cicada killer wasps' advantage to feed on periodical cicadas because they come out earlier in the year and only once every 17 years. So they've evolved to provision their nests with paralyzed adult cicadas that come out every year. So this will not lead to an increase in those numbers.
Matt in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Matt.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I grew up in Oklahoma, and it seems to me in the late 60s that I got more than, or I'm not entirely sure, but I didn't live there long enough. I moved here when I was 18, that I got more than one batch, and they went like, Eeyore, instead of the sound that I heard Brian play earlier. So I was just wondering, is there that much of a variance between the different parts of the country?
And here again, here are the cicadas that supposedly were recorded, I think, in this area the last time, and they're probably going to sound something like this. Now, Dr. Kritsky, how many cicadas would it take to make that sound?
That would probably take a couple thousand, maybe,
wow.
in a cluster of trees. Yeah, those are periodical cicadas.
And compared to the sound that Matt was just making of the cicadas from Oklahoma?
The sound that Matt was making sounds like one of the grass cicadas. There are several species of cicadas in Oklahoma. There are, and I don't know where Matt lived in Oklahoma, but only brood 4 occurs in Oklahoma with the periodical cicadas, and that's along the extreme eastern part of the state. So, Matt, if you're still on the line, did you live in along the east side of Oklahoma?
And Matt's gone. But
okay, Matt's gone. Well, it sounds like the song that he was illustrating sounds like more one of the annual cicadas, the ones that come out a little bit later in the summer. Brood 4 of the periodical cicadas does occur there, but it's very sparse and is restricted to the eastern part of the state.
Before you go, I've read that you've eaten a fair number of cicadas. Is that true, and are they good?
I wouldn't say a fair number. I haven't had any since 1987. That was one of my early days of working. I've been working on periodical cicadas for 45 years. And one of the discussions always is, can you eat them? Yes, you can. I don't eat them anymore. I've had them in things like stir fries and batter dipped and deep fat fried and blanched in salads and things like that. And they have a green flavor to me. They tasted like what I would say. The closest thing it reminded me of was a cold canned asparagus, uncooked. That's what they reminded me of. It's, as I say, it's a green flavor. I don't eat them anymore because, well, how to put this delicately, they got me tenure. And so, I owe my career to these insects. And so,
you don't want to kill them for food. I get it. At least you didn't say they taste like chicken. Dr. Gene Kritsky, Dean of the School of Behavioral and Natural Sciences at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati, and author of many books on bugs, including Periodical Cicadas, The Brood 10 Edition. Thank you for all the information. That was really, really great.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
And folks, here come the cicadas. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And first of all, thanks to Bridget Bergen for filling in the last 2 days. And here we are in a morning where the complicated economic recovery from COVID became even a little more complicated with another surprising new number. As described by MarketWatch, the consumer price index jumped 0.8% in April, 4 times more than economists predicted in a Wall Street Journal poll. That means the April jump pushes the annual inflation rate to 4.2%, the highest since 2008. Now, this comes after April's surprisingly weak jobs report that came out on Friday, under 300,000 new jobs, fewer by hundreds of thousands than economists had predicted, and with the unusual duality, therefore, of many job openings, but not that many new hires. So those don't seem to fit. Fewer new jobs, but rising prices. And then there's the surge in growth rate, somewhere between 6 and 11% growth in the economy. Wow. But that was expected because things had gotten so slow in the depths of the pandemic. Many times close to zero isn't necessarily that big, but it is a big growth rate. But again, how does it fit in with so many people still hurting, a looming eviction crisis, and more? But the Federal Reserve, to complicate it even more, is predicting it will keep interest rates near zero for years. That's the opposite of what they usually do to tame inflation. Now, one thing we know, the low number of jobs led Republicans to complain that pandemic unemployment benefits are causing people to not take jobs that are available to them, forcing President Biden now to say this.
Anyone collecting unemployment who is offered a suitable job must take the job or lose their unemployment benefits.
But it's not that simple, according to the president. Biden also said this.
Americans want to work. Americans want to work.
And he also said this.
Our economy can't achieve its full potential until we get more people vaccinated.
Vaccinated? Since when is that an economic indicator? So what the heck is going on with the economy, and how might it affect you? With me now, Jim Tankersley, New York Times White House correspondent, self-described economic policy nerd, and author of the book published last year called The Riches of This Land, about the people who built the middle class in this country and how he says they are the ones who can get us out of the current economic crisis. Jim, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's a delight.
Can you describe this morning's Consumer Price Index report in some more detail? It's only like an hour and a half old.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that the very basic way to describe it is that we knew there would be inflation showing up this month, particularly because prices kind of fell a lot last year in the midst of this of the pandemic at this time. And we knew there'd be a big rebound that, hey, a year later, the economy's getting back to life again and prices are going up again. But the big news out of this report is it's rising faster than we thought. And that's true kind of across the board. It's true that like food and fuel, more volatile parts of the economy, are seeing their prices rise month over month, not just year over year, at a faster rate than forecasters expected. But it's also true that things like used cars are just getting much more expensive, much faster. And I think the easiest way to read this report is that it's a real sign that right now in our economy, we have a mismatch between the things people want to spend money on and what's available. And whether that mismatch persists and leads to like a long-running big inflationary spiral is an open question right now. But certainly for the moment, for lots of reasons that have sometimes very little to do with public policy, there's just a bunch of stuff people want to buy that they can't get enough of. And so prices are going up.
We're in such a weird moment of recovery from a voluntary shutdown of the economy because of the pandemic. How do we know if anything right now predicts longer-term problems or good times?
We don't. I mean, I think we know a few things based on some fundamentals of the economy. You know, we knew we were going to see higher year-over-year inflation than what, you know, it would look to some degree like a mirage. And there's some of that here, for sure. But I think that, you know, on the other points, it's really hard to tell. And so that's why, you know, economists always caution, don't read too much into 1 month's jobs report or 1 month's inflation report. But now in particular, seems like the right time for everybody to kind of take a deep breath and then try to wait a couple of months for more data. You know, we just don't know, for example, if a whole bunch of workers are going to come in off the sidelines and start taking jobs once they're fully vaccinated. We think they will. That's what history suggests. But we're not sure. And that number is going up every month. We also don't know, you know, if right now the restrictions that are still in place on things like restaurant capacity are driving up prices in restaurants to a greater degree than they will be when everybody can reopen fully. So, like you said, it's an unprecedented time for those of us who follow this stuff.
So, listeners, help us report this story. Put some of your individual stories on the bones of this economic data from the last few days. Number one, are you seeing prices rise? Or if you own a store or otherwise sell things, are you raising prices? If so, what kinds of prices are you seeing rise? How much? Or what kinds of prices are you raising by how much and why? 646-435-7280. Is anyone not taking jobs that are available to you because of pandemic unemployment benefits? You don't have to use your real name. 646-435-7280. Conversely, is anyone not taking available jobs because of pandemic uncertainty regarding the virus itself, as the president indicated, or your child care, as the president also indicates? 646-435-7280. Is anyone listening right now an employer having trouble finding workers? Tell us your story. 646-435-7280. Is anyone listening right now not taking available work because the pandemic has made you fundamentally question what you want to do with your life? We're going to talk about that too in this segment. 646-435-7280. Or your own economics nerd theories or questions for Jim Tankersley from The Times at 646-435-7280. Jim, what'd you think of Biden's relating the low job numbers to needing a higher vaccination rate? Because people are still uncertain about the safety of many workplaces, we know that. But does it relate to this?
There's definitely an effect. I think whether it is the dominant effect that explains the miss on Friday between what economists had expected and what we actually saw, I'm not fully sold on that. But the numbers are stark. It's more, you know, from the time that the jobs report data were compiled in mid-April until when they were released, another, I think, 20 million, 20 plus million Americans, you know, got fully vaccinated. And that's a lot. I mean, working age Americans. So that's a lot of people to suddenly be available, perhaps to go to work who hadn't felt safe doing so. And I think, you know, obviously we've seen in the last, you know, several weeks is a declining rate of vaccination. So if that is really what is holding people back, I think we will see that reflected in a pretty strong number next month. Like, okay, people are vaccinated, they want to go back to work, they're going to. But it's as you alluded to, it's not just whether people feel like they are safe going back into the office or taking a job in a restaurant again. It's also about, you know, whether they are physically able to do it because they have somewhere safe to send their kids, whether that's to school or childcare. And there, I think we still have pretty good evidence that there is a supply constraint in the economy of just of childcare, and that that is holding back, in particular, working women in a way that could be resolved, hopefully, in the next few months, but could also be a real drag on this recovery.
Let's take a phone call. Linda in Nassau County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my husband is a contractor and a business owner, and the supply of things like plywood, anything you need, any kind of building materials, any kind of doors, even the hardware, everything is backed up. And of course, you know, there have been reports on the ports in California having days, you know, weeks of backup there. And, you know, then you put on top of that the whole computer chip, you know, problem, and the fact that they just didn't produce things last year. Last year was a tremendous year where things just were not produced. If you pull back production and then you expect that, you know, when the economy starts to open up and, you know, people want to go back to work and they want to produce, you know, get their jobs done in a timely manner, if the product, you know, for your business is not there, it's a tremendous mismatch.
This is a piece of it that we didn't even mention so far. Product unavailability that something like a contracting business would need in order to go forward. Jim, I'm curious for you as an economics reporter, have any question that you want to ask Linda before I let her go?
I mean, I first off, Linda, I think you're really well describing a phenomenon we've seen. And I'm just curious of your husband's business. Has he seen a surge in demand for people who want his services over the last few months?
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. People want to, you know, fix, first of all, they're getting their tax returns back. They got stimulus money. A lot of people in our area have worked all the way through. I'm just happened to be very lucky in that respect, you know. And then the other thing that, you know, when you talk about child care and the people that are unemployed, you know, maybe holding back, if you look at the amount of money that somebody gets in the New York area on unemployment, it's not, you can't survive on it. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe in a very low income area, they could survive on it, but you cannot survive on unemployment in New York.
Linda,
I mean, all unemployment pays for is health insurance.
Linda, thank you so much for your call. Really informative. And Jim, to her last point, I read a stat that the only people who refuse jobs are low-paid workers well below the national median income, which doesn't even account for the higher cost of living in an area like New York, those national stats. And so there's an argument that if lowly unemployment benefits are better than pay at a job, it shows employers are getting over on their workers way too much with low wages. How much do you agree with that? Maybe Linda's call is a little bit of evidence of that, or see it as an analysis of an economic reality in this country of why people aren't taking jobs.
Well, I do think, just to step back for a second, I don't think that's what the policy was meant to do. I mean, the policy was meant to help people who had lost jobs through no fault of their own, and then to help people who for whom it wasn't safe to return to work yet, and, you know, and to try to replace their lost wages. It wasn't meant to be a sword wielded at companies to force them to raise wages to get people back. Although, you know, some progressives have sort of embraced that argument, I think, in recent weeks. So I think it's important to remember, like, the point here was to try to keep people whole if they were tossed out of the job market. And then there's this separate question about whether wages are sufficient. I think, you know, for a lot of people, they obviously aren't. And, you know, we have way too many people who earn way too little, you know, not a middle class income in this country. But I think the sort of what is happening right now is much more complicated than that. It's not just, oh, companies aren't paying enough to their workers, and they need to do that if they want to get them off the sidelines. It's that there's just been these huge changes in supply and demand, like Linda was talking about. And so in some places, workers are in huge demand, and they're having to raise wages a lot to try to get people in, and they, you know, they can't get the materials to sell to the customers that they want. And so, you know, you're not seeing the boom in construction jobs, for example, you might like to see, because those are very high-paying jobs, and their wages are going up. But in, for example, in the hospitality sector, wages are having to go up because restaurants are having to find ways, either through signing bonuses. My colleague Gina Smalik and I wrote about this week. Signing bonuses, other sort of enticements to get people to come to work for them because either they have more options, or they are able to still collect unemployment, or they're still nervous about returning to work, and companies have ways of trying to get people over those humps, and they're turning to them. But the thing that they do not seem to be doing as of yet across the economy is like sort of wide scale wage increases like what you're talking about.
Let's take another call. James in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with Jim Tankersley, White House correspondent and economics reporter for the New York Times. Hi, James.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call, Brian. Big fan. One of the things that I don't think is really being taken into account is the individual agency of workers. In the pandemic, for people who didn't lose their jobs, we've had an opportunity to see a different future for what employment could look like. We've had the opportunity to see what a flexible hybrid option is. And a lot of employers are just expecting, now that vaccinations are up and wages are back, that workers are just going to be chopping at the bit to return back to work. And that's not the case. I left my job. I took a buyout option during the course of the pandemic just so I could focus on finishing my master's degree. And one of the things that I'm looking for in the job hunt right now is not just a standard 9-to-5. That's not what I'm interested in. I've had the opportunity through internships to view alternative possibilities, and I want that in my future career. I'm young enough that I want that, and no employer really seems to be interested in providing that to me at the moment. So I'm going to keep hunting until I find it. And it's not that I'm not interested in going back to work for Starbucks or Chipotle for $15 an hour when the possibility exists for more. Thank you.
Thank you, James in the Bronx. How about James in Washington? What do you think about that?
My friend Heather Long, who is an economics writer for the Washington Post, had a really interesting piece on this on Friday, basically this idea that there's a great reassessment going on among workers across the economy. People sort of saying, hey, I don't necessarily want to go back to the job that I was shoved out of a year ago. And I do think some of that has to do with questions of like remote work and more flexibility. I know big companies, including the New York Times, are juggling that with their workers' demands right now. But I also think it's this question of people have a little more ability maybe to step back and take a little bit of time to think about those things because they've gotten a lot of help from the government over the last year. You know, if we've seen typical American savings have actually gone up in the pandemic because of the large amount of government aid. And so if right now you have a few more weeks to be choosy about which job to take, maybe you're doing that. We don't know for sure in the data that that's what's happening, but I think it's a very plausible story for why you might see the rebound in job creation to be a little slower than we thought.
Angel in Trenton, you're on WNYC. Angel, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned primarily with the living wage, as well as, is there a different living wage for people whose children are below school age? In other words, people who need to pay for care for their child. If it would almost be illogical when taking worker agency into account to expect a person who is taking care of their child now and not receiving a government stipend if they return to work to then resume paying for their child care, or if their child is in hybrid learning, they would now have to be paying an additional sum for a school-age child who is not being seen in person in a school district more than 2 and possibly 3 days per week. So they would have to, in order to return to work, they would have to pay more than they were prior paying for childcare, while possibly not even making a living wage. It would almost be illogical for anyone to return to work while making a non-living wage if they have school-age children or children under the age of school age.
It's such a great point. And in fact, it's one that the president himself makes. He's got this families plan, right? That's part of the big two-part infrastructure plan. with affordable child care to working families and the preschool for 3 and 4 year olds. And it makes intuitive sense, right? If people have kids in hybrid school or are uncertain about September reopenings, plus everything else that Angel just said from Trenton, they don't know how much they can work, Jim.
Yeah. Yes. And I think actually, you know, this is one of the more overlooked parts of the American Rescue Plan, the $1.9 trillion aid package that the president signed into law in March. There's actually a lot in there to help with child care, to help lower and middle income families afford it. There's a tax doubling of a tax credit for it. And then there is this monthly stipend to all parents, whether their kids are in child care or not, up and down the income spectrum with a pretty high cap, actually. So almost everybody who has a kid in America is eligible for some form of it. So it's not enough to, you know, dramatically change the living wage calculation for all parents, particularly parents who are just earning a median income. But there's a lot there. There's thousands of dollars a year there for people, and that could make a real difference. But that's a one-year program. That's why the president's pushing for this American Families Plan, which would be a much more sustained effort to reduce child care costs, to give more money to parents, to make the expansion of the child tax credit permanent. And the White House, even today, is going to sort of lean into that argument and basically say, look, we need more of this. We need an economy where parents have the support they need to work to the degree that they want to. That's going to make them more productive.
We'll continue in a minute on the weird, contradictory economic realities of this moment and how they affect you with Jim Tankersley from The Times and your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jim Tankersley, New York Times, White House, and economics correspondent, as we talk about all the contradictory new economic numbers out there today. We'll get to the Federal Reserve Board and why they aren't considering raising interest rates if inflation is suddenly a problem. The new Consumer Price Index report that just got released this morning, if you haven't heard this, shows the economy shows prices increasing at a more than 4% annual rate, which is more than we've seen in this country for overall prices for a long, long time. It may be a blip because of COVID recovery, or it may be something more serious. This is part of what we're talking about, along with many job openings that people are not taking and things like that. And many people are calling in with your stories. That's great. Our lines are full. Hang on. So I'm not going to give the number again right away with many people waiting to tell a story. And Jim, you wrote an article yesterday about Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, as a microcosm of the high unemployment yet trouble finding workers. The article called IPA, that's not IPO, which is initial public offering, this is the beer, IPA signing bonuses and free subs. Tell us about that story.
Well, first off, I'm from Oregon, and we never mess up IPA versus IPO, really. So second off, sadly, I didn't
get to go. But either can be dark. But anyway,
either can be dark, yes. I didn't get to go to Rehoboth and drink any beer. My colleague Gina got to do that while I called people from my house. But what we found was really interesting. You know, a lot of employers throughout the course of the last several months have been warning, and then increasingly in the last month have been saying, we can't get people to come back, and we think it's because they want to take, you know, they want to just stay home and receive their government benefits and not come back to work. And, you know, we just talked to a lot of economists and to a lot of people, actual employers, actual, you know, workers in Rehoboth. And what we found was a little more nuanced than that, that it's true there are a couple of places that report they're having a hard time getting people because of unemployment benefits, but it seems more like kind of a mismatch. There's a hesitancy from employers to give people actual higher hourly pay, raise their wages, because they don't think this surge in people coming back to restaurants or brew pubs or wherever is going to last. You know, it's like, okay, everybody's flush with money and dying to go out. It's going to work through the system, and then it's going to go kind of back to normal. So what they're willing to do is pay people like a signing bonus, a one-time deal to get them back into the workforce, Whereas workers are sort of expecting, hey, this could be permanent. If I'm going to come back off the sidelines, I want wages to make it worth my while. And so there's almost kind of a classic economics textbook mismatch here between what the employers are willing to offer in terms of an actual wage and what employees are willing to take. And so you end up with what looks like a labor shortage.
Loris in West Orange, you're on WNYC. Hi, Loris.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm coming up on a year of unemployment. I lost my job last June. I've been in arts administration for a long time, and everybody knows that industry completely shut down last March. And I have a complicated relationship, and it's multi-pronged complications going back to work right now. I send out dozens of resumes and cover letters every week and haven't gotten anywhere, so I'm doing what I need to do. But right now I'm looking at, I have a 10-year-old daughter who's in virtual school all week, so she's at home and can't be home by herself. The bus line that I would have taken in to take work in New York City shut down over the summer, so I no longer have reliable transportation for a job in the city. And right now we're looking at, Broadway is opening in September, which is fantastic news for everybody. And, Broadway is kind of the indicator for regional theater, too. So do I take a job outside of my industry if I get an offer next month, or do I hang tight and wait a few months and see if things come back and be a part of the rebuild in a post-pandemic world?
How are you answering that question for yourself so far?
I'm not answering that question.
That's the problem, right? Yeah. Loris, thank you so much. And I'm going to go right to Jennifer, who it looks like is calling from the Caribbean. Is that right, Jennifer? And
yes,
if so,
Brian.
Where in the Caribbean? It's a big place with many countries.
I'm in Barbados, Brian. I'm in Barbados, but I miss my home, New York. I came here to find work, because America doesn't want to hire older people anymore. Is this a chance to pivot? Is it a chance to give us the opportunity to get back into the workforce so we don't have to leave to go outside to work? Why are we being put aside, Jim? Is there a chance?
Calling the guest by name. Jim, it's on you.
No. I think that's right. I think what we're seeing, I can't hire that many people myself, so I don't know that it's on me. But the stats tell us that we have seen a wave of what appear to be retirements of older workers in America because of the pandemic. They sort of either they lost their jobs and they've retired, or they're having a hard time getting their way back into the workforce. And so, I think the longer this goes on, that there are 8 million jobs open across the economy and not enough workers to fill those, the more the opportunity should be for workers who have been in the labor force a lot longer, older workers, to be able to successfully gain those jobs. And I think, obviously, this is something that is not new to this recovery, but I think there may be a real chance here, especially in the next couple of months, for older Americans who want to get back into the labor force to do so.
Jennifer, are you finding it easier to find work in Barbados?
Yes, I am. I mean, I live, between the U.S. and Barbados, have been for years. But it is crazy that I work remotely. I am tech savvy. I am very astute at business. I do business consulting. And I have tried repeatedly to get work. So I'm hoping this is a chance. This is an opportunity for us older girls and guys to get back out there.
Jennifer, thank you. And please call us again from Barbados, or if you come back home to New York, call us again. Jim, she mentioned older workers. You mentioned some things with older workers. Is there a fear of COVID that runs along an age spectrum? So because older people are more vulnerable to getting really bad COVID if they get it, that they're resistant to returning to work for that reason?
I don't know. Actually, I haven't seen data on that sort of fear of returning to work broken out by age. What we do know, though, is that older Americans were faster to get vaccinated. And so If anything, they should have kind of less competition in the ranks of the vaccinated versus sort of younger workers who have had to wait a little bit longer. And in particular, I would think that you might see that a little bit, if you're going to see it, you would see it in this month's jobs report for May, because that's where, you know, the gap is starting to close, and the younger workers or younger Americans who want to work and want to be vaccinated are basically catching up now. But there was this sort of window when there really were more people, you know, over the age of 50 or 60 getting vaccines than certainly people over the age of 18.
And this has been a gender uneven recession, with women being hit much harder than men, the opposite of the Great Recession of 10, 12 years ago. And of course, it's women who also do the most childcare. Our caller Angel from Trenton was talking about this before, but how do you see the recovery so far in gender terms in the job market? Are the jobs for women that got lost disproportionately coming back disproportionately?
I think what we're seeing in the job market is that women continue to bear the brunt of this childcare crunch in the country, that particularly mothers are just not returning to jobs as fast. And that is a real problem for the economy. It is if we can't figure that out and solve it, we are going to permanently lose or for a long time lose an incredibly highly skilled group of workers who, because of social expectations, are the ones being forced to bear the brunt of a broken childcare system across the country right now. And so there's obviously a lot of debate in Washington about what to do about this, but I think the data are really clear. We need and want more women to be able to return to work, and we just haven't gotten there yet.
Here's a tweet that says, as an architect who specializes in affordable and supportive housing in New York City, we experience incredible difficulty getting appliances and construction materials and increases in prices this year as we were finishing up building. So that's just another report from the construction industry. One more call, then we're going to be out of time, and we have mayoral hopeful Catherine Garcia standing by. Andrew in, I think I have a phones problem. We can't get the caller up? Okay. So I will ask you a closing question, Jim, and that is the Fed and interest rates. They said recently that they're going to keep interest rates near zero for years to come. But usually when inflation starts to rise, that's one of the tools for, you know, knocking it back down, is rising interest rates. So is that a mismatch that you can explain?
I think what we're seeing right now is the Fed, two big things. One, the Fed is looking past these monthly numbers and saying, hey, we've got to keep the big picture in perspective here. And I think they're very much preaching this idea that a lot of these surges in prices are going to be temporary. They're going to wear off, and the economy is going to be fine. But the second thing is, the Fed is willing to tolerate a little bit higher inflation than it has in the past, because we've been having lower than normal inflation or lower than what the Fed considers desirable inflation for going on a decade now. And so what the Fed is signaling is, hey, we're going to keep interest rates low and maybe let inflation run at 2.5% a year, as opposed to their target of 2%, for a little while to kind of catch up and keep the labor market, you know, hot and keep the economy growing for people.
Jim Tankersley, New York Times White House correspondent, self-described economic policy nerd, and author of the book The Riches of This Land, about the people who built the middle class in this country and how they are the ones who can get us out of the current economic crisis. And Jim's article that you may have seen in the Times yesterday about Rehoboth Beach, that beach economy as a microcosm of what's going on nationwide now with offering people free subs and IPA beers and stuff like that to get them back to work. Jim, really informative. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Era on WNYC. So now let's talk about summer and how parents can navigate the reopening of travel options, summer camps, backyard barbecues, and like we were just discussing, ballparks. All available for those of us who are vaccinated, but even if the FDA approves the Pfizer vaccine for 12 and up, as it's expected to next week, that still means parents and caretakers of younger children will be navigating some bumpy terrain and trying to decide what the acceptable level of risk is for the kids in their care and for themselves, because it's not settled. For example, the CDC has set guidelines for summer camps that many think err on the side of too much caution. And New York Magazine found an epidemiologist and a pediatric immunologist who called the guidance cruel and draconian. Even Dr. Fauci acknowledged that they were a bit strict, his term, on the Today Show. So we've invited Dr. Daniel Griffin to join us again to talk through some of this. He's been on the front lines of the pandemic with his patients and advising doctors as an infectious disease clinician and a researcher at Columbia and chief of the Division of Infectious Disease at the ProHealth Medical Group. Hi, Dr. Griffin. Welcome back. Thanks for coming on again.
Oh, good morning. My pleasure, Brian.
And listeners, we can take some of your questions for Dr. Griffin. Do you have questions about summer camps, how to travel in mixed groups, vaccinated adults, unvaccinated children? How are you planning your family summer vacations? 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. So, Doctor, I guess part of what makes this complicated is that the risk assessment for kids is different than for adults, given that kids are at a lower risk of serious symptoms, even if they're infected with COVID-19. So if the adults around them are vaccinated, then what constitutes risk?
No, I think that's a great question, Brian. And I love the way you phrase it, because it is clear that children are at lower risk. That is clear. But they're not at no risk. So we're trying to balance the fact that kids can get COVID. Kids can die of COVID. Kids can end up in the hospital and have long-term issues. But at the same time, it's really hard for these kids, right? Every summer you miss is a summer you're never going to get back. So we're trying to balance that. And I think the CDC is getting beaten up a little bit over their guidance here. And I think Anthony Fauci was the kindest by saying it was a bit strict. But hopefully we can go through this with the listeners, because this is challenging. How do we balance the risks with really the need and the desire of all these kids and their families to have an enjoyable summer 2021.
So does your advice differ from what the CDC is recommending? You've advised camps and sports teams.
I have advised them, and I continue to, and started in this space last summer. And actually, I think the largest camp that I advised was a camp with about 1,000 kids. And it was very successful. Smaller camps that had sort of more water exposure than others. Some were just purely land-based. What I think I should point out is that this is a very complicated document as far as the guidance goes. Some of it is really clear, and I'm on board with. The other, there's subtleties to it. So they strongly encourage vaccination. That's critical. They're also finally jumping in and really endorsing and saying there should be testing so that we're not bringing folks with COVID in there. But then I'm going to say there's subtleties of interpretation relative to masks, physical distancing, how we're going to do that. And to remember, this is guidance. The actual rules are going to come from the governors of the states about what is specifically required. What's the size of a cohort? When can we get those masks off? And the CDC is already starting to talk about certain circumstances, such as if the kids are vaccinated, if they're going to be in the water, you know, things like that. So the kids will not, even if you follow the strict interpretation of the CDC guidance, wearing masks, you know, 24 hours a day at these camps.
And I think that might be different than what people have heard, because one of the guidelines that seems to be drawing the most public criticism is that the CDC is recommending masking outdoors for children at summer camp outdoors, except when swimming. You're saying it's not that strict?
Well, so those are the two areas where I think the CDC is getting a lot of criticism, and it's masks and it's physical distancing, right? So they are saying, and this is a little stricter than I think a lot of people were hoping, that all people in camp facilities should be wearing masks at all time, with exceptions. And then they start laying out some of the exceptions. I've seen a lot of news articles where they say, oh my gosh, you know, no special needs kids will be able to go to summer camp. But they've clearly said anyone with trouble breathing, anyone who would not be able to get a mask off as needed, those people will not be required to wear a mask at all times. So they're already starting to say, let's use a little judgment here. This is not meant to be draconian. This is meant to allow us to say the camps can open safely. We're just going to have to make decisions about masks and distancing. But I think, as you bring up, Brian, I think as we've all learned, outdoors is incredibly safe. If you move from indoors to outdoors, you've dropped your risk by 95%. A mask is an 80% reduction. So you got to start looking at these different layers. Vaccination, that's the nuclear option. That's really going to change their summer experience for so many kids.
Stephen in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Dr. Griffin. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yep.
Hi. I think kids are pretty much safe. And the guidance from CDC have been giving us that even in school, they want us to be 3 feet apart instead of 6 feet apart. The kids don't have that much of mortality or even infection rate as an adult. And we really need to open the schools already a long time ago. But in my perspective, I want my kids to be out. I want them to be playing with other kids. I want them to be in camps. The camps probably wants to have, probably they need to have precautions of some sort, but I don't mind my kids to be around them. I'm sending them to the sleepaway camps. I'm sending them to Florida, to New Hampshire, to whatever. They have to be out there in the summer. They have to get back to the schools. They have to be back to the kids around them, get social. Yeah, I'm not really concerned about that COVID thing.
Stephen, thank you very much. Dr. Griffin, I don't know, maybe there's somewhere between Stephen and the CDC where you would come down. But another thing go ahead. You want to comment on that call? Go ahead.
Oh, certainly, Brian. No, I mean, I think one of the things we say in public health is that when you succeed with your public health interventions, everyone says, oh, why did you worry so much? So success seems to invalidate things we do. And here in the U.S., even as a lot of people felt like Stephen, oh, kids, you don't have to worry about kids. A lot of the moms, I'm going to give moms credit so that the angry involved dads can call in. But the parents said, you know what, I am going to keep my kids safe. And doing everything we did, we shut down schools, we had the kids wear masks, we did these, you know, virtual learning programs. We still had hundreds of kids in the U.S. die. We still had thousands of kids end up in the hospital. You look at Brazil, where they didn't take this seriously in kids and there wasn't a lot of mitigation. Thousands of kids died. Over 1,000 babies are dead. So I think that, you know, people have this perception, oh, you don't have to worry about the kids. We haven't seen a lot of kids die. We've seen 200 kids die in the U.S. alone. In my mind, that's a lot of kids. That's way too many. The reason the number is 200 and not 1,000 is because we've done all these things. And we don't want summer camp to be a place where we see kids dying. I mean, I think that we can do this safely, but we can certainly also do it unsafely. We do not want Stephen to say, oh, my gosh, I was wrong, because now we're seeing, you know, pictures of dead children at summer camps.
Dana in Mendham, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
So I was just wondering, I don't have a child who's old enough for summer camp yet, but I have a 10-month-old that I'm still nursing, and I'm fully vaccinated, and we're still trying to navigate how do we be around, like, other children in the family who can't get vaccines and other family members who might not be vaccinated yet, knowing that the baby might have passive protection, but knowing that there's not a guarantee for that either.
Doctor, can you advise Dana?
Oh, certainly. So Dana, great that you're vaccinated, and actually great that you're probably passively vaccinating your 10-month-old. You know, what the CDC came out and said, I think yesterday it was public, saying, you know, we give all this guidance, but you know what? For vaccinated people, it's a very different world. People who are vaccinated, particularly, you know, young mother like yourself, incredibly low risk of getting infected, also incredibly low risk of spreading it to others. So, you know, to carry this into the masking world, into the camps, but also for you, if you're vaccinated, if you're breastfeeding your baby, you're really low risk for these other individuals. And so the CDC has said, hey, small groups, vaccinated people, even indoors, the masks can be off. You can start hugging people. You can start spending time again. If you've got a high-risk individual, let's say maybe you've got that uncle in his 70s who has cancer, who's on certain medications, you know, maybe there you want to make different decisions. But for a lot of us, it's going to be really much of a return to normal come July, particularly with vaccinations. And we're hoping come Tuesday, 6 a.m., we're going to hear an expansion of the EUA for the Pfizer vaccine down to kids 12. And if we hear 12 and all the way up, these kids can get vaccinated. The chocolate-covered carrot of vaccination is going to mean these kids are out there having fun with masks off. Maybe that's going to get rates low enough that those kids below there, maybe if the rates are low enough, we can start extending that freedom.
The chocolate-covered carrot. What flavor is the stick?
It's all covered in salt, Brian.
Salt and sugar and fat. The low risk of serious illness for kids, does it create a bit of an ethical dilemma when it comes to vaccinations? Are the children being vaccinated to protect their teachers and grandparents, for example, more than themselves?
So, Brian, I don't think they are, in all honesty. And I brought up the experience of Brazil. That destroys me to hear. They over 1,000 babies have died of COVID down there because they have not taken all these measures. And, you know, I was talking with the head of our pediatric group, Jay Berger, the other day about a child he had just admitted to the ICU, a young kid in his teens. No, the kids can get COVID too. Kids can die of COVID. Kids can end up in the ICU. Kids can end up with long-term consequences where they can't concentrate in school. They can't participate in sports. Kids need to be protected as well. We do not know the long-term complications 10, 20 years from now if we let all our kids go out and get COVID.
Sarah in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. Thank you so much for talking about this. My entire family works at day camp, and we've been camp counselors for many years. And my real question is on the lakefront, are lifeguards going to be required to wear masks? My question is, the kids are unvaccinated. The lifeguards will be vaccinated, but having to jump in at a moment's notice with a mask on could be a safety issue.
Yeah, so that is a great question, and the CDC specifically addresses that. That's one of the settings or activities, as they say, such as eating, drinking, or swimming, right? If you're there trying to make sure these kids are safe, if you're going to have to jump in at a moment's notice, you don't want to be taking this time to pull off that mask. You want to be ready to go. CDC has clearly said the risk benefit here is get that mask off, be ready to jump in. You don't want to be jumping in the water and realizing you've got a wet mask that's impeding your ability to breathe, or the delay is preventing you from being able to keep these kids safe. So everything here is a risk benefit balance.
Ali in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Dr. Daniel Griffin. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Yes, it's you. Don't listen to your radio. Listen to the phone. You'll hear me in real time. Ali, do I have your name right? Ali wants.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me? You're
Hi.
On the air.
Yes, I can. So thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to know about the vaccines and I guess their availability to school-age children. How do we see this kind of being like the flu shot, similar to like where the children are going to need to take it on a regular basis? I know you're talking about summer plans, but do you have a view, I think, just kind of the way things are going, if we're expecting that this is going to be just like a mandate, the way other schools have said, or some universities have said that to come back? I know, Brian, you had the president of Rutgers on. Eventually, do we think that's going to be the mandate for children as well? And is this going to be like the flu shot where they're going to have to take it on a regular basis?
Thank
sure.
you, Dr.
Happy,
Griffin.
Yeah, happy to address that sort of large picture thing. So, yes, we're already hearing from a lot of schools that they anticipate that come the fall, this will be a required, just like all the other vaccinations for school attendance. So we're seeing at university level, we're seeing that that's probably going to extend down lower. One of the nice things I will say is Pfizer is now looking for full licensure. That sort of puts it into the normal paradigm we're used to. Not something EUA, but something fully licensed. We expect the other vaccines to follow suit. So this will be the normal paradigm. Hey, before you go off to college or school, there will be, you know, required vaccinations. There'll be the normal exceptions, you know, that we're used to over time. Now, will this be an every year? The interesting thing we saw, the really encouraging thing we saw, is kids, teenagers, adolescents really have a robust response. The Pfizer data was incredible. They were following these kids, testing them weekly. None of the vaccinated kids tested positive. It may be that younger kids have a more durable response than adults, which would be fantastic. This may become one of our childhood vaccines. We'll see. The data is still going to follow. But hopefully this isn't something you have to get every year. But we'll see.
So is it safe for extended families to go on vacation together this summer with the unvaccinated kids and the vaccinated grandparents?
So I think, again, this is going to be sort of each person looking at a risk benefit. You know, as mentioned, kids, if you don't protect them, as we saw in Brazil, things can go really poorly. We want to keep those kids safe. I think it's going to be a no-brainer for 12 and on up. And if incidence rates get really low, it's going to depend where you want to go on vacation. If you're going to a place where there's really low rates, then I think that that's reasonable. If you're going to these large crowded areas in places that maybe do not have the control, the success that most of our country will have by July, that's a different scenario. But no, I think we can look forward for families really having a great summer.
The CDC guideline, tell me if this is right, vaccinated people can hang out with one unvaccinated household?
That sounds about right. And I think that, you know, one of the tough things, right, Brian, this keeps moving forward, and it is moving forward. The guidance keeps changing, but the guidance is changing as we learn more and as those rates drop. And my anticipation is when we get to July, when rates here we're seeing in New York, percent positivity rates are below 2%. I think they'll be below 1% rather soon. We're sort of falling off a cliff thanks to the nuclear option of vaccines. Then things are going to be even more liberal.
Real quick, we have 30 seconds left. Your reaction to what we were talking about earlier in the show, Governor Cuomo's reopening of Broadway, full capacity, no vaccination requirement for the audience September 14th. You good with that?
I have to say, you know, people by then, if you want to have a vaccine, you're going to be able to get it. If you choose not to be vaccinated, then you're taking a risk.
Dr. Daniel Griffin, researcher at Columbia and chief of the Division of Infectious Disease at the ProHealth Medical Group. Thank you for all your work and all your information again.
Oh, thank you. And everyone be safe.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.